want it this way. It made sense it would take someone I'd never noticed who came out of nowhere to love me. Bradley thought I was beautiful, but he didn't know me at all. That was probably for the best. The closer he got to me, the closer he'd get to the bad in me, and that would not do. There was no beauty in my badness, and there was no hiding my badness from anybody who got too close. For him, I was good. When I made him laugh, his eyes sparkled, and he smiled, revealing his gap teeth stained a faint yellow. It made me think of the Alfred E. Newman comics and the Mad magazines I read five at a time at the library. If that guy lived in a trailer and was a 14-year-old pack-a-day smoker. I felt addicted to the way Bradley talked to me about me. It reminded me of my father's letters telling me I was the best, the greatest, the most beautiful, and the only one. I didn't believe a word, but I believed that someone else did. And as long as I could maintain that, it would be enough for me. I ached at the thought of Bradley not telling me I was beautiful anymore, and simultaneously prepared for that time to come. After a week of stolen chats before school and more whispers about my beauty, I thought the least I could do was give him my number. He called me immediately after I got home on the last day of school. I didn't tell my mother. I was 12 years old, plenty of girls I knew had boyfriends, but my mother would only see one thing in any boy or man she saw me around. "Can I tell you something?" I could hear a smile in his voice through the phone line, and I smiled too. "Of course," I said. "I love you," he said. I could still hear his smile, but mine fell. This was the first time we'd ever spoken on the phone. And even though I wanted to be loved ferociously and completely, it seemed like it should have taken more than this to get here. "How do you know that?" I heard him take a deep breath before putting his smiling voice back on to say, "I just know." It shouldn't have worked. Or maybe it absolutely should have worked on a 12-year-old sad black girl in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Here was a boy offering me what every other girl was becoming obsessed with. Love. I wasn't sure if this was love for me, but it seemed like the kind of thing you jumped into and figured out later, like all the happy couples on television. "Okay," I said, smiling again, my mind made up. "I love you too." Christmas was approaching. And my Uncle Clarence and his wife came and got me and my brother for a surprise trip to see my father. I don't know if my mother expected him to show up out of the blue, but she let us go with him. I trembled with excitement and held my brother's hand in the back of the van. The night before the visit, my uncle used his new camcorder to record me singing Silent Night, my favorite holiday song that year. Wow. He watched the video of me singing, rewound it, and played it again. "You have to sing for your daddy tomorrow." I wanted to, but I couldn't imagine it happening. Back in the van, hours away from seeing our father for the first time in years, I asked my Uncle Clarence why my father was in prison. He turned off the music and looked at his wife, who met his eyes. Then he looked at me and my brother in the back seat. "Nobody ever told y'all?" I shook my head. "Well," he shrugged, "this might not be the right visit to talk about that." I saw my father through the small window of a heavy locked door separating me from him. He was already looking at me. He found my eyes and held on to them. In all my life, no one else has ever looked that happy to see my face. He was surprised by our visit, but not by me. He knew me. When the doors opened, I walked toward him, and he opened his arms to me. I laid my head on him, and in a room full of convicted felons, found the only place I'd never be anxious to move on from. My Uncle Clarence said, "She wants to sing for you." And I did. I sang Silent Night, slowly and carefully, and with all my heart. Everyone in the waiting room clapped when I finished. My father held both my hands and said, "Wow, how did I have you?" That was the last I'd see him for a long time, but I thought of him every day. Chapter 15. Bradley said he loved me so much and so often, I thought it would be mean to tell him I didn't feel the same way. If all it took not to hurt him was to do a little pretending, that seemed okay. I did that all the time anyway. I wasn't great at it, but I figured it would be worth it in the name of love. Besides, I thought, people always think I'm great at first, and then they find out I'm not. At least Bradley was just a boy who didn't even live in my neighborhood. He wasn't family. When he got tired of me, when all the good feelings about me left and he saw I offered nothing to replace it, he would leave on his own, and I would probably never see him again. I could be patient long enough for that to happen. To be sure I didn't hurt him, I could wait. He was 2 years older than me, but only one grade ahead. I thought I wanted his attention, but I was grateful we had no classes together, and running into him in the halls always left me with a sick feeling in my stomach. He would want to hold my hand or scrape a dry kiss across my cheek. He went after my lips every once in a while, and sometimes I allowed them to land. That wasn't a good idea. After he'd crossed that boundary, he wanted to cross another and another and so on. Pretty soon he was pulling me just out of the sight line of teachers, parents, or whoever happened to be around so he could put his hand under my shirt and squeeze my growing breasts. It hurt me, and I didn't like it. I told him that, and he told me I was beautiful and he loved me. That meant he couldn't really help himself. Nothing he said felt right to me, but I didn't quite know what to say to correct him. Up until that point, one of the only things I liked about our relationship was that I had no desire to be physical with him, and therefore believed I was in no danger of shaming God or my mother by having sex before I was married. I thought not wanting him would be what kept me safe. My cousin said having your first boyfriend is how you know you're starting to become a woman. I didn't want to become a woman. I felt like my father hadn't gotten the chance to see me as a child, and it seemed the closer I got to adulthood, the less I should be seen by anyone. He was missing the best parts. Even this so-called rite of passage, he was missing it. My father would not be there to embarrass me with bad jokes in front of my friends or look at me with disappointment when I brought home a bad grade. There would be no yelling matches or fights over what was or wasn't appropriate clothing to wear outside of the house. No one I dated would ever have to sit through a lecture about my safety or even the slightest hint of a threat regarding sexual activities and my young age. No one would know him. And he wouldn't get to know the best of me, the me I felt like I was losing. My father had been in prison for so long. I believed every good thing about me had come from him and him alone. I couldn't imagine how much better I'd be if he were around, how much better we'd all be. There was no way to tell my father about the small victories or catastrophes in my budding young adult life. He couldn't help me solve the problems I'd created for myself. In some ways, I was grateful. He didn't have to see what I felt I was becoming. He didn't have to watch in disgust as my body grew into something that could only be perverted, something I couldn't stop from happening. This wasn't the part of my life where I wanted him to meet me. I dreamt of that moment, and it had always been so much more beautiful. I had been so much more in that world. Out here, in this world, I felt myself being dragged down a path toward adulthood, but I wasn't done swinging on the playground. I wanted my father to know me while I might still resemble the girl he wrote about in his letters. In those letters, I was still his little girl. I still had flowers in my hands and sunshine in my eyes. My desire for a physical representation of my father's love led to me pursuing parental relationships with all kinds of authority figures I came into contact with. They weren't all aware of their parental status, but they were all important to me. Combined with my mother, they made up the perfect parental figures, proud of me, hard on me, and charmed by me. They were my Danny Tanners, Carl Winslows, and Aunt Beckys. Not only was I not their child, each day I got closer to not being a child at all. My body was changing, as were my thoughts, and I was terrified by them. My mind was caught somewhere between extreme longing for love and tenderness and the fear of being mishandled or misused. Even as I was drawn to connect with the people around me, I feared them, afraid of how much they might come to mean to me and how terribly I would have to mourn when they inevitably left me behind. At night, I'd sit in bed and say to myself, "Everyone leaves. You'll be okay. Everyone leaves. You'll be okay." I'd say it over and over until I could picture them leaving, until I could feel the tears on my cheeks. When I cried, I thought I could feel some of that inevitable pain, sparing my future self. It burned right in the center of me and rolled my gut, but it kept my heart right where I thought it should be, inaccessible past a certain point. I did not mind getting hurt as much as I minded being surprised by the pain. I wanted to see it coming. The adult men in my community noticed my body was changing before I did, and they did not hesitate to keep me updated. As I became a teenager, the parts of me I had largely ignored made people uncomfortable, in some cases downright angry, and they really needed me to know that it was my fault. I was walking home from middle school when a man pulled his car over and asked me for my phone number. I stared at him for a beat before saying the only thing I could think of. "I'm 13. He looked as if he didn't believe me. "Go home and tell your mama she needs to be dressing you like you're 13. You almost didn't get treated like somebody's child." He spit out of the open driver's window in my direction, then sped off. I stood there, shaking, surveying my jeans and t-shirt. What about my clothes said I wasn't 13? What about me kept telling the rest of the world I wasn't a child? I walked home, already knowing I wouldn't tell my mother what just happened. He hadn't touched me, and I didn't want to upset her for nothing. We lived on a corner lot, and I was sometimes lulled to sleep by the sound of cars idling at the stop sign 30 feet from my bedroom window. That night, each idling car set off an alarm system inside my body. I alternated between finding a spot on the wall to stare at and drift, and curling up into myself, trying to cry as quietly as possible. A week later, my mother stopped me as I climbed into the car. "You need to change your shirt." It was my favorite shirt, denim with puffy sleeves and a mostly lycra bodice. It was tighter than it had been 3 months ago, but still pretty and still my favorite. I dragged my feet on the return to the house. The rest of the family was already in the car, my grandmother in the passenger seat shaking her head. She turned to my mother. "When did she get so big?" My mother sunk into the driver's seat, watching me walk away. "I don't know, but it's only a matter of time until I have to choke somebody for looking at her." I let the screen door slam, walking quickly toward my room. I grabbed a long white t-shirt from my top drawer, something I usually slept in. I changed out of my jeans and into baggy overalls. Nothing to see here, nothing to touch. I'd started wearing the overalls to keep Bradley out too. He was going to change schools when his parents saved enough to move out of their trailer and into a house. It meant his dad would have to be transferred by his job, and the whole family had to move to a smaller city just north of Fort Wayne. Whether or not they would go was up in the air for a few weeks before they decided. His mother was reluctant to leave. She would miss her family. In the end, none of them could vote against moving into a house and out of the trailer park. When it was still a question, before they'd settled on it, when he called me every night crying and telling me we didn't have to break up, I prayed that when they moved away, he would forget my name at the county line. Long distance was too hard, and we were too young. That's how I'd explain it to him, I thought. That's how I'd make him understand. And I did. That night on the phone, my fingers curling in my grandmother's comforter, I told Bradley, "If I give you all of me and you give me nothing back, then what do I have? Less than nothing. Less of me and none of you." "You don't have nothing," he said. "You have me. And one day I'm going to give you everything. When we're married, you'll have all of me and everything else you want in the world. I would die to give you everything." It sounded like love in the movies. "No," I told him. "I don't want to do this anymore." I told Bradley I'd see him one last time. He asked me to come to the meeting spot easiest for me, where we could be alone. No one ever went in or out of the white storage shed in my mother's backyard, and though it was dark, cold, and dirty, it was private. We could talk there, and no one would be any wiser. This time, I knew I could convince him that our relationship was over. We were kids, and he was mean, and I just wanted to be good. Couldn't he let me go so I could be good? When I walked through the door and shut it gingerly behind me, the light from outside moved quickly across his face. I could see he had been crying, and the tears had begun to frost in the cold. I hugged him because I didn't want him to hurt, and he clung to me, his heaviness pushing my back into the discarded washer or dryer just behind me. I let him cry into my shoulder and tell me how sorry he was, and how sometimes he blacked out, and how he just didn't want me to hate him. I told him I didn't hate him. When he said, "I love you," I started to pull away. "Don't do that." He gritted his teeth and tightened his grip around my waist. "Bradley," I said, falling back into a soothing tone for a shot at a safe exit. It scared me how easy it was to hear that sugar-sweet dead voice come out of me. It wasn't me. It was whatever he needed me to be. And I didn't want to be her. I could be good. I could have straight A report cards and special field trips, but it wouldn't happen if I was stuck talking to him like this for however long that may be. And to a 13-year-old, almost any time at all feels like forever. "Please," I said, this time speaking like myself, "I don't want to hurt you. I just want to say goodbye. Can't we just say goodbye and be friends?" My eyes were just starting to adjust to the dark when he dug his nails into my sides, a boy made of fury, and growled, "No." I didn't scream. I didn't know who would come or what they would think was happening when they got here. It hit me that I had made all the wrong choices when I walked into this shed. The weight of his body shifted from my front as he leaned back and pulled me up onto the top of a rusted metal washer-dryer, held both my wrists in one of his hands, and used the other to fumble with the zipper of my jeans. Every time I attempted to yank my arms or legs away from him, they hit the sides of the machine, causing a deep and hollow bong to scare me into stillness. "I love you," he said, his face dripping with tears and snot and cold sweat. "Please," he said, "please." I didn't know what he was asking me for, but I didn't want to give what he was taking. My thoughts scattered and separated, silently running down our list of options and coming up short for a way out. I thought I saw something move in the corner and prayed it was the rat catcoon my grandma told us burrowed beneath this dump. Anything that might bring him to his senses, provide the single moment of interruption when he realized what he was about to do and decided not to. But it wasn't an animal, mythical or otherwise. It was Jerry, Bradley's friend, watching us and hiding. Bradley wasn't going to change his mind. He was doing exactly what he'd come here to do. He lowered my pants and underwear with one hand, and the cold metal of the washer collided with my skin like a million needles. I was out of time to think. Nothing and no one was coming to save me, and since I could not save myself, I went away. I closed my eyes and let someone else take my place. I floated off into the frozen day toward the weak sunlight breaking through a sparse set of clouds. It had never been this hard to get back into my body. On the shed floor, my back to an icy metal appliance and my front curled in and around itself, I looked like a slug who was trying to sleep or die. I was there, and I was desperately trying not to be, and then I was gone. There was something in me that felt too good, too innocent, for what was happening to this body that kept getting me into trouble. When I realized what was happening, what he meant to do to me, what he'd already begun to do to me, inside, I screamed. My mind split. It stayed silent to stay safe on the outside. But in my body, a word traveled from the tips of my toes to the top of my head. And it said to that small, sweet part of me, the only loved part of me, run. I couldn't imagine who would have wanted to stay there. A long time after both boys slipped out of the door, hopped over a fence, and snuck through my neighbor's backyard, I tried slipping back into places like an arm or a foot or an ear. Each time, a pain, sharp and cold, bit at me, warning me to stay back. It felt like I'd spent hours with my mind hovering above my own body, terrified to fully enter and find it cold or worse, empty. I didn't know how long I'd been there, and I could only be sure of at least one thing having happened, but I still felt like I was missing something. I began to cry, and my brain began to wake to the alternating pain and numbness in my hands. Panicked, I might have to explain the pain to someone if I couldn't control it. I shook my hands until my whole body was shaking, and then I couldn't stop the shaking. I shivered and shook until I was able to drag my sore body from the shed in an upright position. I hoped I wouldn't draw attention to myself. Halfway back to the house, I turned and looked at the shed, thinking I should go back. I left something, I thought. I left something important in there, and it's too cold to go back for it. My body and whoever lived in it now walked back into my house. I met her there. She tried to tell me what had happened, but I wouldn't let her inside. Chapter 16. I stopped wanting to go home. I wanted to be somewhere that was safe, where I wasn't alone. No one questioned why I wanted to spend so much time in and around school. Sure, I'd been in trouble a few times for behavioral issues, but I was still known as a smart and curious kid. Maybe even in the right light, at the right time, charming. School was safe. I was stronger there. I stood up for myself there. I didn't want to go home. I still cried all night and slept too little. I stopped going into the backyard, Since my mother wasn't home from work by the time school ended, it didn't take long to realize if I just didn't get on the bus, I still had a few hours before I needed to walk home and be there by the time she arrived. It was risky. She could always come home early, find me missing, and be boiling by the time I unlocked the door. Then there was Bradley. He could always be waiting, knowing there was a better chance she would be gone and that I would be unprotected. I'd take my chances with my mother's rage. After the last bell of the day, I would walk to my locker, collect my coat, book bag, and a few folders, then slip into the nearest bathroom where I could wait until I could no longer hear voices in the hallway. About 10 minutes after the silence, I'd hear the long groan of several school buses pulling out of the parking lot, one by one. I'd count them until the last one faded. Only then would I push open the bathroom door, careful not to make noise or be noticed should anyone be closer than my ears assumed. When the coast was clear, I'd step into the now silent expanse of my educational institution. It all seemed bigger when I was there alone, and I felt bigger too. If I ran into a teacher, I'd explain that I was staying after for some activity or another, and they believed me. Sometimes I would visit the parts of the building where a few kids really were participating in practice or a meeting for a sport, team, or other student group. I could slip in and chat a bit with the few kids, make them laugh, and be moving on before I was caught. Whatever I'd lost in the shed, it was good to know it wasn't this ability. Being invisible was still my superpower. I tried not to think of what had happened to me. Most of the day, I could succeed in that mission. Then, a shock of ice-cold air on the wrong side of my face, the rattle of plastic meal trays against the hard metal counter during breakfast and lunch, feeling too sad or feeling surrounded, and I would be back on the roof of the shed, looking down at myself, pathetic and mumbling nonsense. I hated that place. I hated everything in my view, including the ball of rotten nothing called my body curled into itself on the floor. Why didn't she get up? Why didn't she go away? She never should have been there at all. Staring down at myself, I admonished her, blamed her, and only spoke enough to say, "Stop bothering me. Stop bringing me back here. We don't belong to each other anymore. You made the choice to go in there. Now you can stay there." My after-school wandering kept me from having to go back. I was the best of me somewhere in between the drab school walls. When I left them, I was nothing. And nobody cared what happened to nothing. And everything happened to girls who were nothing. It took 3 weeks for me to figure out who the other stragglers were and perfect my rounds. First, I'd visit with my choir teacher, Miss Wagner, for as long as it took her to pack her things and head out to her forest green Subaru. She was my favorite, one of those I'd initially found prickly, but she didn't like to dawdle after hours, and I did not blame her. After that, I'd visit the student groups and make my way down to Mr. Unway's classroom. Mr. Unway was my social studies teacher. He was one of the few people who seemed to genuinely enjoy my questions, so I asked a lot of them. It made sense to me to keep that same rhythm after school was done for the day. I would just stand in the doorway and ask him questions. I tried to make them interesting to him, noting ideas that had come up during class or sharing some slightly deeper research I'd done into relevant subjects. He would chat with me and answer my questions, and then I'd move on. Whatever we spoke about was usually pretty boring, and I felt no need to hang around. It wasn't Mr. Unway, who was a very nice man. It was that I needed to move. The point was to wander. Stopping in and speaking to teachers was just a good way to hide. If a teacher, staff member, or any other adult should come down a hallway and see me, they would be suspicious of my presence. I wasn't supposed to be there. But if I was standing with or talking to another teacher, the suspicious party, eager to mind their own business, would simply accept that I was under someone's care. I was there, a reason to be concerned. And then, with a quick wave of rational thought, I was gone from their mind again. Almost 2 months into making my rounds, I ran into Mr. Martin. He was my computer teacher, and I didn't like his class at all. In fact, I regularly slept through it. My body's continued refusal to sleep through the night meant I couldn't stay awake when I was bored. I couldn't control it. Where I had once been able to daydream myself away in moments of weak concentration, I now found nothing but a sweet and impolite slumber. Smack! A teacher's hand would come down against my desk, just beside my cheek. The louder the smack meant the more offended they were. Some teachers would call out to me until I woke. More than a few classmates gave me a swift kick or a quick elbow when they caught me fading. Sometimes, they just let me sleep. Mr. Martin never let me sleep. Mr. Martin watched me until the moment my head began to droop. Then he would simply say, "Ashley Ford," and continue his lesson. When one of the boys in my class thought to make fun of me for it, I mocked him for his rat tail until the rest of the class laughed and he cried. Mr. Martin was locking up his classroom, and I couldn't avoid him. He was in the same hallway as the last unlocked exit, and I was supposed to meet my brother at the library before heading home. Before he could ask me where I'd come from or what I was still doing there, I started to ask him questions. He answered my questions right up until we were standing in front of the trunk of his car. He opened the trunk, and its only contents were an entire case of Mountain Dew and a huge stack of our local newspaper, the Journal Gazette. I asked why he had so many papers. He heaved his bag on top of them and said, "I deliver them in the morning." I was confused. Why did my teacher have a paper route? "With your kid?" I asked. "What? You take your kid on their paper route, right?" Mr. Martin smiled at me, but his eyes looked tired. He reached into the trunk, grabbed a Mountain Dew and a newspaper, then handed me both. Mountain Dew wasn't my favorite, but I loved reading the newspaper when I could get my hands on one. I started to walk away with my new things when he stopped me. "What do you say?" I thanked him. He smiled a little. "See you tomorrow, Ashley Ford." When my mother came home, I was sitting at our kitchen table, the paper laid out before me. I stacked the sections by least interesting to most interesting, starting with the sports section and ending with the comics to maximize my chances of reading the whole thing. I did read it all. Any day I could, I visited Mr. Martin and got a Mountain Dew and a newspaper. I said thank you, and he said he would see me tomorrow. I liked him a lot more, but that couldn't stop me from falling asleep in his class, which I continued to do. Interrupting a lesson to say my name had stopped working, and letting me sleep was out of the question, so one day Mr. Martin kept me after class. The bell rang, and I moved toward the door. "Ashley Ford, I need you to stay. I'll write a pass for your next teacher." My classmates looked at me with big eyes, and I swear Rat Tail giggled. Being held after class usually meant you were about to be in real trouble. The kind of trouble the teacher didn't even want to bring up in front of the other students. Everyone here knew why I was being asked to stay after, and most of them were probably wondering why it had taken so long. For a moment, I thought I should say something, explain what seemed to be happening in my body, and how the old ways weren't working for me anymore. I wanted to defend myself. Then I was back on the roof of the shed, just where I didn't want to be. "Sit there." Mr. Martin pointed at the student's desk closest to his. I sat. He was going through papers on his desk, putting them into folders and putting those folders into drawers. He didn't speak, and I was glad because at that point, I could not have responded. I heard the shuffling of notes and assignments beside me, and I followed the sound back into this moment and away from the shed. I wanted to take a deep breath, but didn't want to look like I needed one. My brain screamed, but I maintained my composure until I no longer had the desire to take heaving breaths. He was already talking by then, and I'd missed a bit. I listened closely until I could trust myself to know what was going on, as if I didn't know what was going on. It was the sleeping. It was distracting. It was disrespectful. I had to do something about it. Yeah, I thought. I know. Is there a reason? He asked the question like he wasn't even sure he wanted me to answer, which was fine by me. He tried again. Is something happening to you? Something that keeps you from sleeping? I began to laugh. Yeah, being afraid of the dark is happening to me. It wasn't a lie, but it might at least sound like a joke. Mr. Martin did not laugh with me. He sat back in his chair and looked at me until I felt forced to look away. I wanted to be seen, but I didn't want to be watched. He turned around in his seat, fumbled through his bag, and handed me a cassette tape. Just play it while you sleep at first, he said. Then try playing it with just your closet light on. Then try playing it with no lights on. It helped my daughter when she was little. It might help you too. I looked down and read the label. Return to Pooh Corner. I put the tape in my pocket and stood to go. I'd gotten to the door before I threw a thank you over my shoulder. A few days later, I was asked to stay after class again, this time by the teacher who liked my questions, Mr. Unway. Ashley, do you think your behavior toward me has been at all inappropriate? Inappropriate. I hated that word. It always meant that the breasts I hadn't asked for were moving too freely, my most comfortable shorts were too small around my ever-growing thighs, or my body was betraying me in some other way. I said, no. Do you think that hanging out in my classroom before or after class in small clothes is something a nice girl would do? I wrapped my arms around myself. My clothes weren't small. They were a little tight. My body kept growing, but only in certain places. I did my best to cover up, to hide it, to keep looking like someone's little girl. But I was visibly losing the battle, and had been for some time. It wasn't just me. We were all changing. I enjoyed peeking at the other girls in the locker room while we undressed. It was hard to ignore their maturing bodies or stop comparing them to my own, but I didn't want to make them feel like I felt most of the time. I didn't want to make them feel watched. Did they hate this too? Did we all hate this together, but cry about it separately? Mr. Unway picked up on how uncomfortable I'd gotten and asked if I'd come speak to the principal about this with him. I followed him out of the classroom and into the hallway because it seemed right. He walked 5 steps ahead of me, and as we rounded the corner toward the principal's office, I spun around and walked in the opposite direction. By the time he called out for me, I was already running toward home and my tape player. When Mr. Martin asked why I didn't come around anymore, I made something up about babysitting my siblings. He had been kind to me. He'd helped me. But I was not his daughter, and my clothes were too tight, and I didn't want him to die. Any kindness that existed between us was bound to be tainted by how I looked and how that made any interaction rife with the potential for wrongdoing. Who I was inside, who I wanted to be, didn't match the intentions of my body. The outside of me didn't present a little girl to be loved innocently. My body was a barrier. I took solace in the tape that helped me get over my fear of the dark. Kenny Loggins sang to me the way I wanted my fathers to speak to me, with wisdom and love and the belief that I could still be good. I gave up on the men I knew in real life, but I couldn't give up on the man whose voice found me in the dark. That was the beauty of Kenny's music. I never have to grow away from this safe space. The voice on my tape, a celluloid dream or memory track, didn't know me in real life. He would never have to watch me grow up. He would never have to consider me appropriate. He only had to sing and remind me that I was still here, in this body. Every part of me was still here. At the end of the school year, Mr. Martin caught me in the hallway on my way to the bus and handed me a laminated bound volume of the ramblings I'd written in his classroom. "You wrote a whole book," he said. "Don't forget you did that." Chapter 17. In all my hallway wandering, it was never my intention to settle in any one place, so I didn't. I didn't want anyone to get too close, and I didn't want Bradley to come looking for me. I walked down the halls, occasionally listening as an announcement came over the intercom. They were always announcing awards or accomplishments. My name was never called, but one name was always on or at the top of the list. Brett Tubbs. I hated that name. Day after day, I rolled my eyes at the mention of this Brett Tubbs, who I did not know and hoped I would never be so cursed as to gaze upon. It was only a matter of time, though, in our small school. I wanted to hate him so bad the first time I met him, the first time he made me laugh. I'd walked into the classroom where the newspaper club would be meeting and saw his name on the board listed as one of the students expected to join. I rolled my eyes and found a seat with my back to the wall, the entire class in front of me. I sat there, fuming at the idea of him, of potentially having to work with him. And then he walked in. He smiled at me as I glared at him and said, "This'll be fun. The teacher's kind of a dumbass." Yes, I despised the idea of a goody-two-shoes boy, so good at doing whatever adults told him to do, too dumb to know none of it mattered. But that wasn't Brett. Soon, my hatred turned into a deep and urgent pining. Brett exuded a sense of control over himself and over his life, and I was drawn to his steadiness. His love for music helped too. By the middle of the semester, I was working on the school newspaper, playing intramural soccer, and had fallen in love with color guard, and most of it was because of him. I didn't even know myself, but I liked myself. Maybe I did hate the idea of him, but the reality of him made me feel like I had never been less invisible, like I was finally safe. He asked me to join color guard and then marching band, and because he had gone from nemesis to necessary in my mind, I made it happen. Well, we made it happen. In band, at least in our band, nobody was supposed to have to do it alone. I didn't have to rely on my mother for rides to practice because Brett would pick me up without complaint. Mr. Caffey said if we were 5 minutes early, in our places, ready to go, then we were on time. If we arrived at start time, we were late. Brett was never the kind to be late, so I was never late. It felt good to show up morning after morning and know I'd already done the first thing right. It felt good to know that Brett would always show, pulling into my driveway at the same time every morning. The consistency of it, knowing he would be there when he was supposed to be, felt as warm as all the best summer days, the good 4th of Julys. Marching band took up most of my time, and I liked it that way. It kept me from thinking about home or anywhere else. Being away from home meant being away from my siblings, and I hoped less of me in the house would even out to be for their own good. Even if it wasn't, it was what I needed. To be separate. My presence brought tension, and I told myself being away was the only way we were going to make it out. Even when I was home, I tried to be gone in some other way. Lost in music, lost in a book, and often lost in another phone conversation with Brett. That's who I was talking to when I heard the front door unlock and the heavy smack of Alan's boots against my mother's linoleum entryway. I sighed into the phone. Alan is here. We continued our conversation, content to ignore his arrival, when my bedroom door swung open. He stood in the yellow-lit doorway, rocking back and forth on his heels, his hands clasped behind his back. "Where's your mama?" Barely looking up, I told him where she was, running late from work or running an errand or whatever was true. I didn't try to be pleasant. I'm sure I rolled my eyes or seemed impatient. He knew I didn't like him, and I felt no need to hide. He released his hands and held up a plastic bottle. Alan thought my little brother should be done with bottles by now. I didn't know if he was right or not, but I agreed with my grandmother when she said, "If he wants him to stop having a bottle at night, then he can come actually stay with his baby at night." Even before Jorian was born, it was rare for Alan to spend the whole night in the house with us. Even if he stayed late, in the bedroom or out in the living room, halfway holding court for a few adults who'd come to visit, I always heard his car peel away at some point in the night. I listened to my Kenny Loggins tape on a low volume in bed each night, but sleep still came later for me than everyone else in the house. If I knew he was staying, I turned it up a little louder. He was always saying things I didn't want to hear. He held the bottle in front of my face and said, "Y'all know I don't want this shit in the house." I looked from side to side, not worried exactly. One of the biggest arguments my mother and I ever got into was right after Alan had spanked my sister for annoying him. I'd yelled that he wasn't her father and wasn't allowed to touch her. I told him if he ever touched her again, I'd call the police. My mother yelled at me. She told me to shut up. She told me he paid bills that my sister's father didn't pay. Alan smirked, threw his hands up, and walked out of the front door. My mother kept yelling. She told me I had to go out and apologize. I spoke to him through his car window. "If you ever hit me or any child that doesn't belong to you ever again, I will call the police. And I won't ever stop calling the police." That felt like a good warning to me, so I didn't expect he'd ever forget our terms of engagement. He stepped back into the hallway and slammed my door. I heard a cracking sound in the kitchen and walked out to find him stomping on the plastic bottle. He wasn't really succeeding at breaking it and looked ridiculous in the act. Brett was still on the phone, which I spoke into as I watched Alan. "Okay. He's losing his mind." I rolled my eyes and turned back toward my bedroom. I walked into my room, shutting the door behind me, but it stopped short and bounced back. I turned just in time to see Alan coming toward me, hand outstretched. He grabbed the phone from my hand, then brought it back down across the side of my face. "Get the fuck out of my room," I exploded. He'd hit me. This monstrosity of a man had crossed my line. Not again. My mind rattled with fantasies of how I would get him back. Brett was no longer on the line, but I was sure he'd heard what happened. Alan left my room, and I sat down on my bed. After a couple minutes, I found myself packing my book bag full of underwear and special things. I thought of every place I'd ever felt safe and found the list sparse. Maybe any place was safer than here. I knew that wasn't true, but sometimes I wondered. I put on my coat, opened my bedroom window, and climbed out. The headlights on my mother's car were just dimming as I fell onto the bush outside my window. She opened the car door, stepped out onto the driveway, and stood there staring at me, confused and angry. Another set of headlights came around the corner and pulled up behind her. Brett was in the passenger seat and his father was behind the wheel. My mom looked at them, then back at me, and finally at Alan standing in the doorway. "What's going on?" she asked. Neither of us answered. I walked right past her and toward Brett's window. Her voice rose and she asked again, looking back and forth between where I stood and where Alan stood. "What is going on?" I ignored her, looking at Brett instead. He looked right back at me. "Are you okay?" he asked. I nodded and tried to smile, but the attempt made me look even more pitiful. Brett leaned toward me, unblinking, lowered his voice, and said, "You can come with us right now." The fear that my mother may have heard him forced my best imitation of a real smile to my face as I shook my head and said, "No, it's fine. I'm okay. I'll see you tomorrow." He looked skeptical, and so did his father. But there was nothing they could do or say to make this better for me. We all knew that was true. I didn't look at my mother until they'd rounded the corner, out of sight. When I finally did, she was already in a state. "What the hell were they doing coming to my house? For what? I could expect something like that from Brett's mom, but his dad is black. He at least should know better than to come to my house to check on my child." "He came to check on me because your boyfriend hit me with a phone." I looked at Alan. "I told you," I thought. "I told you I would tell, and I did." He looked back at me. My mom looked back and forth between us. Then she settled on me, her face hardened. "Bullshit," she snarled. She didn't believe me, and I hated myself for being hurt by it when I should have known better. I felt like I was choking on my own life, drowning in it. My home didn't feel safe. My mother was in love with a cruel man. Bradley was still calling my friends and their parents, asking them to send me messages. They didn't know what had happened, but they could sense things weren't right, maybe even that I needed help. In more than one uncomfortable conversation, I asked the friend's parent not to pass on the messages, and maybe, if they could, to block his number. One night, he called the mother of one of my girlfriends. He told her he had a gun to his head and asked her to give him one reason why he shouldn't pull the trigger. She hung up. The next week, Bradley and a friend showed up during a late-night band practice. The band was rehearsing a show on the blacktop next to the tennis court as the sun set behind the rolling formations. My friend, the girl whose mother had taken that awful call, spotted him before I did. My bandmates closed in around me, and Brett quickly led and devised a plan for distracting Bradley and his friend. He walked a small group over to Bradley and tried to engage him with conversation while my bandmate Ryan hustled me into a car and drove away. Just as I strapped myself into the passenger seat, I heard a knock on the window. Bradley's face was red, swollen, and barely restrained. He held up a photo of me, my school portrait, grabbed both ends of the picture and began to tear it into smaller and smaller pieces. Ryan peeled out of the parking lot, and when I asked him to take me back, he kept on driving me home. I rested my forehead against the cold window, barely registering the passing houses, streetlights, or which road we took. It had been the right thing to run away from Bradley. I knew that, and yet I continued to cry, believing I had hurt him, rejected him, and that the fury I saw in his face was my doing and mine alone. I felt like my father would understand me if I could just tell him what was happening inside me. I wanted to tell him everything, to confess the bad parts of myself and have someone say, "I still love you. That will never change." I looked for my father, for his unending love in the faces of every adult around me. I knew he would know how to protect me. He might even know how to help me protect myself. Chapter 18. In my father's absence, my grandmother did her best to stand in. She'd never heard of tact, but she was still a harbor in the stormiest days of my childhood. She was not warm and endlessly loving as I imagined my father to be. She was real, and as real people often are, she was complicated. She had a critical streak and it cut deep. And if my mother didn't like feeling distant from me, my grandmother found it untenable. She insisted on being the solitary place I sought guidance outside of God, but she did not always feel safe to me, and I hated that about myself. I didn't want it to be that way. I felt her need for us to be close in the way she still gripped my hand when we crossed the street, and I blamed myself for my inability to ignore my feelings when they came between us. In the throes of my deepest anxiety, it's her voice I hear warning me of other people and what they might say. At first, I didn't know who other people were, nor did I understand how concerned I should be about their perception of my actions, good, bad, or otherwise. But I spent so much time with my grandmother, and she spent so much time talking about other people, I eventually had some idea about the bad things they might say about me. They might say my clothes are too big or small, or maybe even they look old. If I'm hypervigilant about my personal hygiene, they might tell others about the time I used to stink. They might not be there for me. They might not love me. My grandmother didn't see this as gossiping or being critical. She thought she was being helpful. Her fearful desire not to be talked about expressed itself as a constant monitoring of other people's behaviors and presentations of themselves. And she offered swift judgment whether the behavior or presentation was good or bad. Most were bad. This frustrated her to no end. Why weren't people more careful? What kind of woman left the house without wearing lipstick? How could anyone let themselves get that fat? Who raised them? Who let them become this way? Didn't they know other people would talk about them? My grandmother would sneer at and side-eye anyone on the street, but especially women she thought underdressed, mismatched, or sloppy. The stakes, she had impressed upon me, were too high for women to fall asleep at the wheel of our own potential. She believed that for women, beauty was as much a requirement as an opportunity. What were you going to do with yourself if you weren't going to be pretty? I don't think I ever saw her take joy in applying makeup or getting dressed, but when someone else noticed the time and effort she'd put into her appearance, she'd give them a small, closed-mouthed smile and nod her thank you. Her eyes would sparkle. If other people were going to talk about her, she was going to choose what they talked about and how. My grandmother couldn't understand how every woman and girl she met wasn't exactly as concerned and deliberate in her choices. When she caught sight of these careless women in the wild, her lips would tighten. It was unladylike, I had learned, to speak ill of others at a volume in which they might actually hear you. My grandmother, ever the lady, would lean closer to my ear so as not to offend the offender. Her musky perfume sat heavy in the back of my nose, and if I opened my mouth and breathed it in at the same time, it tasted like the warmest version of my oldest memories. She spoke in a low voice, her slight southern accent curling the ends of her vowels. "Now, you wouldn't ever see me out here looking any kind of way. Thank God I raised all y'all better than that." As a child, I would nod or stay silent. My opinion was neither desired nor required. When my grandmother spoke that way about other people, she was reminding herself of something she believed more than she was discussing the merits of her life choices with me. The never-ending barrage of criticisms she hurled in every direction was often funny, and I assume, at some point, compulsive. She didn't lie. She really believed she was keeping herself safe and her family safe by holding us all to the same impossible standard. Somewhere along her lifeline, my grandmother had gotten the idea that other people's opinions could kill. With her criticisms and corrections, she hoped to build a wall of perfection around herself and those she loved. As a family, we might face trial and tribulation, and we may even let our hair down, but not for other people to use as ammunition against us or our family's name. The sharpness of her words were meant to hook into our soft outsides, toughen us, shield us, and become our armor against the prying eyes of a stranger's judgment. Being my grandmother's favorite meant being watched. Sometimes I wanted her to take me away, but after a while, she made you feel bad about yourself. She could be loving and protective and funnier than anyone else I've ever met. But her criticism was incessant. I may have spent more time with her than most of her other grandchildren, but I was not spared, though I did enjoy the very real fringe benefits of her rare and enduring bouts of generosity. We shopped together almost as much as we watched old movies together, not that we had much money to shop with. My memories of various shopping trips are mismatched and often strung together. The markers of time being the size I was wearing that year and how she reacted to that bit of news. I remember dressing rooms, attendants, accessories, and credit card offers. Every time a salesperson asked my grandmother if she was interested in their credit card, she would say firmly, "No, not today, thank you." They may have been trained to bring it up more than once, but after she spoke, no one ever did. This particular afternoon, she was supposed to take me to the Glenbrook Mall. I'd been sulking because my mother and I had gotten into an argument about Alan earlier in the day. "You just don't like him." She always said this to me when I complained about something he'd said or done. And I couldn't defend myself because she wasn't wrong. So I would say just that. "I don't like him. I don't. I have no reason to like him." Then she would tell me about respecting adults, about the bills he paid, about how no one else was helping her, and I knew I'd lost. To be fair, I always lost. Still, it seemed important to keep fighting when it felt like the right thing to do. Our argument ended with me fighting back angry tears and my mother pacing the house and intermittently opening my door to tell me another reason why I was wrong. I knew I'd made a big mistake. If my mother got angry enough, or if she worried I'd talk about any of this with my grandmother, she wouldn't let me leave to go shopping. There wasn't anything I wanted more than to get out of the house, and I might have just incinerated my only guaranteed chance to do that all weekend. My grandmother walked into the house with the weight of our battle still hanging in the air. "Ashley, let's go," she said. I ducked into the living room where my mother was folding clothes and told her grandma was ready to take me to the mall. She looked up at me with a hard stare. "Don't run your mouth. Everything you feel ain't for everybody to know." I nodded and left the room. After we locked the door behind us and walked down to the bus stop, my grandmother turned to me. "You and your mama got into it?" I shrugged. She looked down the street like she might see the bus, then back to me. "You not gonna tell me what it was about?" I didn't like the way this felt. No, I hated it. I hated it when my grandmother asked me about my mother because she wasn't going to help me, not really. She would listen, and sometimes she would even agree with me, and that used to feel like enough, but that feeling was fading. What would be enough? I didn't want to talk to her about my argument with my mother because it wouldn't help me, and she would use it as a way to criticize her daughter, and I didn't want to hear that. For maybe the first time, I told her I didn't want to talk about my pain. For this, she was offended. We shopped our usual department stores, JCPenney, Sears, and Macy's, mostly in silence or with the occasional, "Do you like this?" followed by a simple head nod or shake. Getting new clothes was not a given when we came to the mall, but my grandmother made sure I always got to grab a little fast food at the very least. When we finished browsing, we headed to the food court. We got in line at Panda Express. It was always the longest line, but I loved the opportunity to people watch. I scanned the various restaurants and their patrons.